Hello, welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, well, we're spending best part of the hour down at Glastonbury Abbey, which is just an hour down the A37, where history was made in 1539 in the dissolution of the monasteries, where Henry VIII, who executed the Glastonbury abbot Richard Whiting because he wanted his money. Simple as that, folks. So the abbey was founded in the 7th century, 712. So it was going for 800 years, dominating the southwest of England. We hear now from two of the education department people down at the abbey. That's Mark Hutchinson and Luke Loder. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. If you have a story or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show.
I'm Mark Hutchinson. And I work here at Glastonbury Abbey, a part of the Living History Education Department. Day to day, I show tourists around, expand and explain the history, and when I have time, I then do the research.
What about local school children? I mean, I'm thinking really of actually primary and secondary age. I mean, this is a fantastic place for them to be learning, isn't it, surely?
Yes, that's why we have an education department, and Luke, who we're going to be speaking to shortly, helps run that. And we have children from Bristol, from Dorset, we're from France and Germany, we have all over the world, we have young people coming, hundreds and hundreds of them every year.
This is a little tiny chapel, it's like a little mini chapel.
This is St Patrick's Chapel, built by Beer, and this was a number of different buildings, and he sort of constructed. This was really for the women who were in the almshouses, which are behind you here. They've been knocked down. These were for the poor women. They were about sort of 9 or 10.
We've got murals around the walls here of what looks like people thinking about the building. I mean, they've got small models of parts of what looked like the abbey here.
You can explain the whole history from here. So we start with Joseph of Arimathea, supposed to have come here nearly 2,000 years ago, and that's him landing, and the Holy Thorn nearby, because he climbs up Wirial Hill.
Joseph of Arimathea, he was the guy who was in charge of burying Jesus after he was crucified.
That's right, yes. And his tomb was used to bury Jesus. We believe
didn't he also have some sort of authority in the Jewish faith at the time?
Supposedly. The difficulty is that in history there's lots of interesting anecdotes. To get the actual proof is difficult. He may have had.
Okay, so is the rich man. Is Joseph of Arimathea coming to Glastonbury just a myth? You know, designed to sort of drum up tourism?
No. Hello, I'm Luke Loder. Anyway, yeah, and I'm the learning assistant here at the Abbey. In terms of Joseph of Arimathea and the legend, I always say it's very much a matter of personal belief. Some people really believe that Joseph came here following the crucifixion and established a Christian community here at Glastonbury. Other people believe it might be part of the kind of web and fabric of the mythdery, as it were, of Glastonbury Abbey, which very much the monks themselves would promote, giving themselves a bit of credence as being this cradle of Christianity within Britain, this kind of original church, you almost say, rather than...
I think you could probably say during medieval times this was rife, wasn't it? Because there wasn't any real ability for people to check facts. And so there would be all sorts of artifacts, things that were supposedly, I don't know, even one of Jesus's toenail clipping or something, yes, which, you know, it would be almost impossible. Of course, there was no DNA or anything to find out whether this was really actually connected with...
Was it fake news?
You know, yes, yeah, exactly.
Fake news isn't new, Donald Trump.
Yeah, definitely touched upon the idea that, you know, many people, there's not a lot of provable evidence for a lot of these claims, and the church is the ultimate authority on these matters. And it's all about the way they you know, build the environment. You know, a lot of times when you come to services within a church in a medieval context, the priests are speaking in a language you don't speak, in Latin. They're often hidden behind a screen. You can't see what they're doing as part of the ceremony or the ritual. You know, I'm up at the top of the church, maybe in the choir. So it's got this almost otherworldly aspect that you're part of but slightly removed of as well, because although you're part of the service, you never quite understand what is happening as part of it.
So just explain how things have changed over the years to bring priests not only out from behind the curtain, but actually sometimes in a very informal context nowadays, with with a circle, with the priest as part of the circle in church service.
Yeah, sure. Well, I suppose you've got the whole idea. It starts way back at the time of the dissolution, and this is where we get kind of Luther and people like trying to make the church a bit more accessible to everyone. The idea that following the dissolution, we have the Bible, of course, being printed in English, a language a lot of people can understand. We also have at this time a great period of an almost social enlightenment. There's a lot more people who are becoming literate, a lot more access to education. So, of course, naturally, this will spread amongst the people.
So this is the 1500s, the Reformation.
That sort of period. Then we also see the following of the changing of the structure of church services. So you might find a priest will do small things and say, like a mass, rather than addressing the altar, he will turn and address the congregation. So you're bringing them into it and being part of it, speaking that language you can understand. So they're opening it up to a more accessible and more of a personal religion rather than a religion through proxy, as it almost has been for hundreds of years with the monks. And having that religion of proxy allowed this kind of monastic environment to flourish and grow and become particularly impressive. And Mark may be the best person to...
Can you just take us around some more of these icons?
Here's St. David, believed to come here about year 500, and he's holding a church. He's believed to have added to the church, which was the original sort of wooden one, believed to have been built by Joseph Arimathea. And then we get St. Deruvian and St. Fagan, isn't it, here? Again, French monks.
This is all about the founding of the abbey.
Absolutely.
Isn't it?
Yeah. 5th century?
In Glastonbury. We've got evidence from the 5th century recently dated from a site called, we call it the Beckery and Bride's Mound, down on the edge of Glastonbury, a small, possibly monastic religious community of some kind founded then. And we've got evidence on the site here from the... if not late 6th century, certainly by the 7th century, there's evidence of Christian activity on the site here.
This is amazing, really, isn't it? You think about Constantine converted, I think it was the Roman Empire, converted, supposedly, anyway, to Christianity in the mid-300s. So it's not long after something going on here.
No, not at all. So there could be some kind of connection. We do see what is not necessarily unusual, but in this area of England, it's certainly unusual for the rest of the UK. We do see what seems to be some form of continuity of that original sense of Christian church right the way through to the founding of the monastery here. So this is through the Saxon occupation of Britain. Of course, the Saxons coming here aren't Christianized themselves. So they come over bringing back their Germanic pagan roots. And that takes a good 150, 200 years for them to fully convert to Christianity after they get here. But there is a suggestion that if during that time there is some form of Christian community here, there are still overthrows and shadows to foundation of a very early Christian community here that hasn't gone away and almost has a unbroken continuity through that period, which is rather intriguing.
St. Patrick here. So here we have St. Patrick, and again the glass up here with the snakes, because he's believed to have got rid of all the snakes from Ireland. He lived in the west of England here before he was apparently taken as a slave to Ireland. He escapes and then goes back to sort of try and bring them some sort of better way of doing things and capturing slaves. So
now, look, before we go out and have a look at the abbey, or what's left of it, can we just talk a little bit about the history of this part of the country, Wiltshire and Somerset? What do we know about, I suppose, what's the prehistory, really, before the Romans? Do we know much about what was going on around here?
Well, we do. I mean, from Cheddar Caves, from just over the border into Wales, one of the first inhumations, that's one of the first burials, deliberate burials in Europe. We have Stonehenge, we have Avebury. So we know that life here goes back. So that is what we're building on, and possibly much before that as well. The wider context is man's search, people's search for, you know, why am I here, what's going on, who's controlling things.
Well, I think we're still on that one today, aren't we?
Yes, I think we are, and I think that's the driving force behind what people have been doing for years in trying to work out what's going on, who's in charge, how can we alter this. And that shows its way through the buildings of Stonehenge and, of course, Woodhenge before then, and various other things. Where the earliest burials with grave goods. Why do you put something in someone's grave if you don't believe there's some otherness, some numinous something out there that you're trying to struggle and understand who keeps the cosmos together? How does it all work?
We're very lucky in the UK that across the UK there's a huge amount of evidence for prehistoric activity in these areas, just as much as, say, up in Scotland, especially over in Wiltshire. Of course, you've got the whole Avebury Stonehenge landscape, an entirely, not necessarily sculpted landscape, but an adapted landscape that appears to be changed for wholly ritual function and use alongside normal living. When you go into other counties, you see small sites that hint at this sort of continuation of search and religion. You go near up towards Bristol, and you've got Stanton Drew, the stone circle up there. You've got evidence even on our doorstep in Glastonbury of this kind of idea of searching for something through another worldly sense. For example, you've got a lot of ritual depositions in the wetlands surrounding Glastonbury. So when people were inhabiting this area in roundhouses from the Neolithic, building trackways across the waterways to reach, we find that off the edge of these trackways there were some exceptionally valuable for the time artifacts which seemed to be deliberately deposited into the waters. Whether those waters are being treated as a liminal point, a bridge between worlds, you're sacrificing your belongings to something otherworldly, an object that to you might be very valuable, a deliberate deposition. In Glastonbury itself, we've got on the Tor, one of our highest points, and what many people in the world still today believe to be one of the most sacred areas of Britain. We find there's a Bronze Age cairn, a burial up there, again, on a high place, you know, close to the heavens, visible by all from far around, and that kind of idea that you're searching for something and kind of putting your own ritual imprint upon a landscape. You're creating your own mythos to help explain things and using the landscape to that advantage.
The Tor is what everyone thinks of when they think of Glastonbury. Was it man-made? And what's the old church tower doing up there?
Well, as far as we know, the Tor is a natural geological phenomenon. It's basically a large sandy stone outcrop left over from the last glaciation period. As the glacier receded and dragged up the levels, it left behind the Tor. And so it is a natural hill. And what we see on top of the hill is what was left of the Church of St. Michael. And that was, depending on how you view it, either a separate church or a church that was slightly linked to the monastery or maybe an outpost of the monastery, certainly being run by the monks and under the ownership of the abbey and administration of the abbey. That fell into disrepair around the time of the dissolution. It wasn't the original church on top of there. The original church apparently toppled during an earthquake in about 1275, so there's been a couple of churches up there. It is also one of the earliest sites for at least Christian-orientated worship evidence archaeologically on top of the Tor. They found pieces of a crozier, a bit like a kind of bishop or priest's staff, a fragment of an early wheel cross that would date to around the early 600s, if not the very late 500s, if you're being a bit optimistic about it. So the Tor's a very interesting place, and certainly has had a lot of importance put upon it by people, whether in the past, historically, or today, and there are many modern myths around
it. It's your logo, isn't it?
Yes, it is our logo, yeah. one of the things
we've got up there in the stained glass window, so you can see St. Michael, because St. Michael, interestingly, is the patron saint of many churches on hills. So you have Mont St. Michel in France, Mount St. Michael in Cornwall, and there he is. And he's the dragon slayer, not St. George. We get it so wrong. St. Michael is supposed to be the dragon slayer. So in social terms, he's the one who's dealing with these terrible things that go on.
I mean, this is a big thing in British iconography, isn't it? The St. George and the dragon. What's the real story behind it? Well, it's not St. George, sorry, St. Michael and the dragon. I mean, the dragon always strikes me as being some sort of, you know, obviously a mythical beast of some sort, but yeah, maybe a dinosaur or something?
Well, I think it's less to that and more symbolic. I mean, you see all throughout medieval text, imagery, even in medical texts, for example, herbalism books, you always have a picture of someone, say, picking a herb out of the ground in one hand, and on the other hand he's got a sword and he's slaying a serpent. The serpent, a worm, a dragon, a reptile, whatever you want to call it in the medieval world, usually represents evil or not necessarily evil, or a struggle to overcome of some kind. And I suppose the idea of St. Michael slaying the dragon is about kind of protection, possibly renewal, this idea that you're overcoming problems and overcoming difficulties.
So how did St. George usurp St. Michael's role there?
I don't particularly know.
Is that the dragon in Western mythology, as Luke has just been saying, was very sort of a bad character. But you get the same dragon from Eastern mythology in China, and they're good, loving things. They're the ones that calm and comfort you, and you have those as nice, cuddly things, whereas here they're fierce and horrible, violent, yes, fire-breathing and really terrible things.
No, I think this is the sort of thing maybe that some of the monks at the Abbey, when it was in its heyday, would have been thinking about these things and would have been uppermost in their minds. Hence, I suppose, you know, the icons and some of the stained glass that was at the time. Probably today we've come beyond that. But anyway, let's...
People believed in this evil. They believed in these spirits. I mean, that's the whole thing. As 21st century people, we go, ha, 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 you know. But this is what they really believed, and they were frightened, and this is a genuine thing.
Going back to the past, you see it all throughout many cultures. The Romans hanging various herbs by the door to ward off evil spirits. Even going forward to the early modern period, there's a big fears of witchcraft and people taking that incredibly seriously. Well, we still found around the UK, you know, witch marks and things burned into doorways and people putting protections and charms on their houses because this was a real threat. It wasn't make-believe. This is 100% concrete and might happen to you. And part of the reason for that is they often don't have a way to explain malaises and illnesses. So if you've got someone who perhaps has got a severe learning difficulty, they might be considered to be possessed by some spirit.
So it sounds to me like you're saying that the church was a hotbed of superstition.
Well, very much so, and I think many religions are, if I'm being honest, a hotbed of superstition, because it's about a way of explaining what you can't explain at that current time. It's about a way of making up for that, and superstition and doing little rituals to try and protect against these things is kind of all you've got, almost, and that's very much...
That's the same today. We were talking of people back a few thousand years ago giving offerings into water. You go to Bath, and what are people throwing into some of the water there? Coins. And that's no different. Wishing wells, that's right. And so we're actually perpetuating what our ancestors have been doing for thousands of years. And it's the same with stones. I mean, you think of Stonehenge, we put stones up. What do you do when someone dies? You know, you put a gravestone up or you put a stone plaque, you know, where the ashes are. Things haven't changed, in a sense.
All these kind of things. It's all about that essence of spirituality, that understanding loss and grieving and understanding events that have happened. It's about a way of marking it in time, but also a way of socially getting beyond this point and finding a solution and a final full stop point to it.
Yeah. Life is ephemeral, it's gone, but trying to leave something permanent to mark the importance of that.
Exactly, and going back to, you know, there's, you know, you've got gravestone today, as Mark said, you've got a burial mound in the past. It's a visual icon of we were here, we did something, remember us and don't forget us, that kind of...
Well, let's go and have a look at the Abbey ruins, which are, in a way, exactly what you're talking about there.
Well, we're standing here in what was called the Lady Chapel, which was the first religious building supposedly built in Europe over 2,000 years ago. And this is a very special place because it's built on top of other spiritual sites here, possibly going back at least 10,000 years.
Okay, well, it seems to me, I may be wrong, is that we're in the sort of the nave of what at its heyday would have been the Abbey. So we've got the ruined walls both sides of us and some arches over the top of our heads as well.
Yes, and the building would have finished at this arch that we're looking at here. So this would be the first building built after the fire of 1184 that burnt down the original Saxon church.
Okay, just trying to put this in some context, this would be just after what they call the Great Schism, which was the big split between Rome and Constantinople, between the Eastern Church and the Western Church. Now, we now think of as the Eastern as the Orthodox Church, that's Russia and Greece, yes, and Eastern Europe, places like that, and Rome, which was all places west, I suppose.
Yes.
So that's around the time, not long after that had happened.
Well, that's right. But of course, the first church here, 2,000 years ago, was actually before that. We have no evidence of that, and so we have this very interesting building built here to sort of represent it's retro architecture. If you look, you'll see the sort of rounded Roman arches rather than the pointed Gothic-y ones.
You've got both here, haven't you?
You can certainly see that as we go up into the main church later on. You'll see a blending of architectural styles. And what they're trying to do here overall is, as you said, retro architecture. They're trying to make the building look older than it is. We have this heritage of Joseph of Arimathea coming here, possibly becoming the first, you know, Christian foundation in all of Christendom or all of the world at Glastonbury, according to the legend. We then have a later, very early Saxon church built on the site, which is definite recorded history. We know there's a Saxon monastery here all throughout the Anglo-Saxon period. That's a very large, very affluent monastery. Then it burns down in a great, what we presume to be an accidental fire.
So it was a wooden structure, was it?
A lot of the Anglo-Saxon buildings would have been wood. There would have been stone elements to them, certainly, especially a large monastery of this calibre would have had a very fine quality carving. But certainly these buildings would have been timber framed. The roof would have had a lot of timber work in them, and that's very susceptible to damage by fire.
And so would that have been a deliberate or accident? We don't know.
No idea. We know that it's in the year 1184-ish there's a fire, or as it's recorded, and that is mirrored by some of our archaeology we find on the site for a burning layer in the archaeological record. It says there is a fire. It's unlikely to be a malicious act necessarily, because that would have been a massive expense cost.
Surely there's hardly anything left of the Saxon church, you know, so it might have been when the Normans came along, there was lots of accidents that happened to the Saxon church.
But then this fire happens 100 years, over 100 years after the Norman conquest. So we're talking by now, this is very much kind of Norman English land, you know, kind of the foundation of the what we call the modern kind of medieval state.
Did the Normans start to think, well, they were starting to think about building cathedrals and that sort of thing? They think, well, we just need to get this old wooden old church out of the way.
Well, we know there's a lot of modernisation at that point. And now, Mark, am I right in thinking that the cloister by Henry of Blois would have been built before the fire?
Yes, there was cloisters
there
here.
There was modernisation here prior to the fire, which doesn't tie in with the fact of this being a deliberate act, this fire. So we had a beautiful new cloister built out of blue lye stone. It would have been stunning at the time. And this is built before this great fire happens, a modernisation. So it doesn't tie in with that narrative of we're rebuilding already. A fire happens and destroys what is left. It doesn't really make sense for that to have been a deliberate fire when there has been investment from post the Norman conquest.
The technology had moved on.
Yes, and style this, was getting old.
This is where we're standing now, was rebuilt for the wow factor. Yes. Now, if you just move over here, you'll see that some of the stonework here would have been actually covered in gold leaf. This is hand-carved stone covered in gold and silver leaf, sparkling away. There would have been, on that east end wall there, would have been this beautiful lapis lazuli paint from the most expensive stone in the world from Afghanistan. So you come in here and you see all these things sparkling. You see these beautiful colours. And where have you come from? You come from your little wooden house with no windows, because glass was only for the mega rich. No chimneys, because the technology hadn't been invented for everyone.
Back earth and floor.
And so you come from this damp, dark, smoky, because the smoke went through the roof, and you come into here, and you go, wow! It is absolutely stunning.
Obviously, people do go to ruins like this around the country. They go into churches. Can you just give us a sort of idea of how to read some of the architecture? Because we've already talked about the Roman arches and the Perpendicular arches. Give you an idea of age.
In terms of architectural styles, I mean, you've got this Roman or Norman style, as we like to call it sometimes today, Romanesque styling, that this building is draws a lot of interest from. And we're talking there, we're looking at the 11th century onwards for about 100 years, give or take. You'll find lots of rounded arches there, lots of jagged designs, like toothed designs. You might see around us here, we've got these kind of jagged teeth in the windows and the things, I like to call them dog's teeth, but they look kind of very emotive of that style. Lots of rounded arches intersecting and things like that. And we then move on to kind of an early Gothic, which is pointed arches, but they're gentle points. They're not really violent, high Gothic Dracula-style castles necessarily. We're looking at these kind of gentle, like you might see ahead of you, these kind of gently curving arches, still nice gentle curves leading up. And then as we go forward, you start to get to High Gothic, which is kind of the height of medieval grandeur as well in decoration. And you might see a bit of an image of some of that by looking at the Tower of St John's Church over this, kind of the top of the tower.
And that's the church that's on the High Street here.
On the High Street there, so that's kind of more of a High Gothic style. So as we go through the medieval period, things change. And if anything, in some ways you can feel the architecture is getting slightly more harsh, I always think. You go from these nice, gentle, rounded shapes and everything gets a bit more pointed. However, that being said, you can read a bit into this architecture and maybe a bit about the focus and reason for it. We go from something that's very rounded and very kind of almost naturalistic and accommodating to the eye, and then we go towards architecture that focuses your vision upwards. The point of these arches, these is you naturally look up. The first thing people do when they look in a modern church, often that's been built in the late medieval period, is you go into a church and most people will immediately have a quick glance up to the ceiling, whether they're aware of it or not. And that's because everything is making you look up. The arches are pointed, the columns are high, and you're going in and your sight is being drawn up.
You know what? I'm going to question what you're saying a little bit there, because I wonder whether these round arches were as good at supporting the masonry above it than the pointed ones. Yes. Surely the pointed ones are a little bit less likely to have the weight on top of the arch,
I'll concede very much there's a genuine kind of, you know, architectural reason for having pointed arches, fan vaulted ceilings, flying buttresses added on, which all look a bit more vertical and a bit more pointed. There's certainly that element to it, but in doing that kind of style, you can't always discount the idea of ulterior motives to this as well. They go hand in hand. You know, it's like we find many styles, and we might find that these pointed arches aren't the most efficient style as for supporting these buildings either. But there's suggestions. What I'm trying to get at the idea is that we shouldn't just look at these things as purely architectural styles. There's a lot of other connections to it. So we're looking at, how these would play to the human emotion, the human experience of visiting these buildings.
And these Roman arches here, these Norman Romanesque arches, I mean, this is over-engineered architecture. It is far too big. You know, it needn't be this massive for holding it up. And that's where the whole thing developed. And being retro, this was done in a retro style, because Gothic period was here when this was built.
And so this building was built when very much we should not be building buildings in the Romanesque style. By now, the common trend was to build buildings in pretty much what we call kind of early Gothic. But what they've done here is they've deliberately built it in the Romanesque style. And as I said earlier, that links back to the idea of that what they're trying to say is, although we don't have this very early monastery existing on the site anymore, they're showing, look, guys, we are older than we actually look. We are the cradle of Christianity. We are the original church. You know, it gives the credence and fits that image of this very early building.
Now, where we're standing, it looks as if the floor has collapsed here. Am I right? And there's an altar in the crypt, isn't that? I mean, that's what it looks like.
Yes, that's St. Joseph's Chapel. That was built, the whole thing was dug out. That's why we have no archaeology of the first early church here, because it's all gone. That was dug out many hundreds of years later to allow more people in. So that's St. Joseph's Chapel, Joseph Arimathea, and this here we are dedicated to Mary up here.
So where we're standing is roughly the original floor level of the Lady Chapel, of the Mary Chapel. So you can imagine the floor sweeping across at this point here an Undercroft chapel, you could call it, down below us. And then,
I mean, I'd say you've actually got quite a lot of stone missing from.
but look at the house at the end. You see
the stone. Yes,
the recycling. We're here. We're great about recycling in the 21st century, trying to get rid of all the plastic in the oceans. Absolutely, we need to do that. But this isn't new. Recycling and looking after. And so people came and took the stone. If you look out over here, you'll see hardly a stone left of where the monks lived, because monks weren't always that popular at that time. Here in the spiritual heart, we still got quite a lot of the stone. Why is that?
Maybe a sense of reverence. Whether or not the people who were here prior to the dissolution, while they're quarrying the abbey, whether or not there was a slight reservation to knock down these places that were perceived as being sacred or still sacred in some way. There's always that sense of reverence to something that's old and of a religious nature.
Also, some of this might be quite difficult to knock down if you didn't have the kit to do it.
Knock down the rest of it.
the rest of it. But
with dynamite.
I definitely think there was some kind of continuity and at least concession towards this being a spiritual place. And that probably or may have influenced their choice in where the exact stone came from. And especially, we're down in the oldest part of the abbey, in one of the lowest parts of the church, where you'd think, actually, this is one of the easiest places to get stone from. But it is the best preserved out of all it, because this was viewed, probably throughout the whole monastery's life, as being, if not the, but one of the most sacred parts of the site. That idea that, do we really want to be destroying a sacred place, whether or not it's in line with our exact church doctrine at the moment, it's still a sacred place. And even that idea of superstition, you don't go there and you don't destroy certain things. You look at the way we know that the Saxons treated Roman sites, you know, the idea that they tended to shun them, live over the other side of the river from the Roman towns because it's full of the spirits, the ghosts of the past, something they don't understand, you know, it's something otherworldly, something different. And that there's always a sense of reverence to these older buildings, and that's probably, in my opinion, why they left so much of these parts behind.
It's interesting. I mean, you go to Rome or Greece, and a lot of the ancient temples have all gone. Yes, and so, I mean, there is reverence in places to the sacred, but in other places, they sort of...
To public opinion at the time. I mean, if we just go through the door, I'll show you an idea. Public opinion at the time, throughout different periods of English history, religion and doctrine in religion and practicing religion has changed greatly. And I don't know if you can see in the wall right next to us here, there's a number of pock marks in the wall. And these are actually left over from musketry practice during the English Civil War, when the Royalists was camped here at Glastonbury. And obviously they had soldiers here who wanted to practice their drill. And you find all...
This is around about, just trying to place it, this is about 100 years after... The dissolution.
Just over 100 years after the dissolution. We know that at the time there's quite a strong Protestant kind of puritanical view in England at the time. And this is all idolatry behind us. So now the abbey at this point is idolatry. It's not current. And then you find all along...
I thought that was the other side. I thought that was Cromwell's lot.
Well, it is, but I think there's a bit of crossover. I think there's a fair bit of crossover at the time. I don't think anyone particularly prescribed. But if you look along the whole southern edge of the church, you'll find these musketry marks in the wall. And whether that was done out of an act of deliberate irreverence, or whether it's more, we have a convenient backstop to our musketry practice, but it does view that at that point, they're not viewing this as something that was particularly... special, necessarily.
That's the first time I've thought of Glastonbury Abbey as a rifle range.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Okay. People are taking pot shots at the Abbey for years and years and for centuries.
Into the church and then to the kitchen?
To the church and then kitchen.
Yep, let's go on up through.
Oh, the sun's come out as well, isn't that lovely? Yeah. Well done.
I see him upstairs does sort things out, you know.
Yes.
You get a good feel of the whole impression of the place from here, really, the grandeur and the size.
Because 177 metres, nearly 600 feet, when it was all opened up, what, about 400 years of building on and off?
Yeah.
And then we look from where we've just been in the Chapel to Mary, and we turn round and look up through the Gothic to where the perpendicular... would be at the end, St Edgar's Chapel at the end there, just finished probably 20, 30 or so years before it was the dissolution.
Now, I'm just trying to compare this to, you know, we're stood in the ruins here, to Bristol Cathedral, for example. It's probably bigger, isn't it?
Far, far bigger than Bristol, yeah. It actually would have been, I believe, the longest church in England if it was still standing currently at this time. That 177 metre length mark is pretty huge. It would never profess to be the tallest. I always think Salisbury Cheats with a spire or something like that. But the length is certainly, you could call it magnificent, and that's probably what they were aiming for, the whole kind of grandeur and size.
And also, so we've got kind of quite a lot of ruins at each end, but quite a lot missing here in the middle.
Yes.
So this is where you think most of the locals would have grabbed the bits of rock to build their houses. Well,
various times over history, we're very much standing on the edge of the nave now. So the nave would be ahead of us here. But yeah, we're certainly missing all the columns. You might see in the lawn there's some marks where the columns would have been. Okay. We're actually standing just off to the side of the north porch. So you might see there's a brown sign under some trees to our left, and you'd have a great entranceway there. That would be the north porch, the main entrance to the church here. And of course that would have been, again, massive architecture, beautifully decorated entranceway, akin to the style you might might see on the edge of Wells Cathedral and things like that, but unfortunately they're all gone today.
I mean, Wells Cathedral, we're standing here. This is where the Wells Cathedral would have finished, here at the beginning of the Galilee here, okay. Is what we call. And Wells Cathedral, of course, built by the same stonemasons, mostly, and in a very similar design. But you can see that the extra bits make it much, much bigger. So this would be the west end, where just behind you standing here would be the west end of Wells Cathedral.
I'm very impressed by the size, really. You think of the abbey as being sort of just abbey size, but this looked as if it was enormous. What can you just take us through the way that, because there's all sorts of, I suppose you've got friars, you've got monks. In what way was this separate to the Church of England, or was it part of the Church of England? How did it fit in what the abbey did?
Well, the monasteries were independent of the parish churches. So we're looking at a totally sort of different organisation. And each monastery varied. Although this was a Benedictine monastery, the Benedictine rule was often sort of changed a little by each convent.
Also, just to put it in context, the Church of England had only started a few years before the dissolution. It wasn't a great period of time.
No, that's absolutely right. So in 1500s, so we're talking here before the dissolution, this wasn't Church of England at all. This was Roman Catholic. And so there were no friars here. But going back to Saxon times, that would have been very different, because I think the whole culture would have been different.
So look, what's the difference between a monk and a friar?
A friary, they're very different. So the Franciscans and people, and the Dominicans, they were interested in getting out amongst the people. They didn't necessarily have buildings or convents that we have in the monastic movement. And so they were more interested in working in society, in taking the good news of Jesus to the society for hospitals and education.
They sound a bit more urban, maybe.
Yes, absolutely. Well, yeah. And rural, urban and rural. So monks were very much cloistered. That's why the word comes, you know, they were here. And the Carthusians wouldn't have allowed anyone else in, you know. I mean, so there were different sorts of orders.
How does the Benedictine, which this was, different to the other orders of monks?
I always like to say, whether it's 100% true, and I always think the Benedictines are kind of the original order of monks, almost. I mean, you don't really get monastic orders in the very early period. We basically have the you know, foundation of the Benedictine order by St. Benedict at Monte Cassino in Italy, I believe, in the 4th century, in about the 4th century, give or take. I believe it's 4th century.
So a thousand years before this place went down.
Is the Benedictine rule gradually travels through Europe slowly and eventually reaches England in the 10th century. I mean, prior to that point, we can say, for example, in Anglo-Saxon monasteries within England, there wasn't a rule book. There was no way of being a monk or a holy individual. Each convent could decide its own rules, as it were. And that, of course, led to a large number of problems where you can have these individuals doing whatever they want, because there's nothing to do wrong, really, because there's no rule to tell them otherwise. And, of course, that actually led to a great slump and decline in monastic living and a big problem. And around that time, we do have actually a connection with Glastonbury here with Abbot Dunstan, or Saint Dunstan, as you know now today, one of our English saints. He'd spent a bit of time in Europe and picked up the Benedictine rule. And when he became Abbot of Glastonbury, he installed the Benedictine rule in on the convent here. And this became the first Benedictine monastery in England. And that kind of kick-started a monastic reform, where this rule slowly spread throughout Britain and revitalised monasticism, because it gave a structure to what had otherwise been kind of semi-organised chaos. And under the Benedictine rule, it allowed these monasteries to flourish. However, with any rule book, there's people who don't like the rules, and then you get dissenters and offshoots, and that's where we get the Cistercians and Franciscans. They are originally Benedictines who didn't like the rule book and broke off to form their own sects and factions.
Okay, what about nunneries, monasteries, women and men totally separate?
For the medieval period, certainly, you would very rarely have any form of dual house, as it were, containing both female and male religious people. You would have visitors, certainly, going to other monasteries. We do find occasionally in the Anglo-Saxon period, certainly of certain minsters, we do have dual religious houses where we have both holy men and women living within the same house together. There are often rules that separate them, but we do find, because there's not that rule book and that kind of taboo necessarily yet from the rules established, it's not bad to have that kind of idea in that idea. When we get later on, it becomes a bit of a no-go area.
Okay, what's the difference between an abbey and a minster? What is a minster?
A minster was really an outreach. So you're thinking of Westminster, York Minster, and all the minsters stayed. At the Reformation, the minsters stayed, but the convents, the abbey, part of it where the monks or the nuns lived, went. And so the minsters were sort of set down to enable evangelisation of rural England, and these were sort of outposts from which friars and other people would then go.
Okay, let's just talk for a minute about the place of Glastonbury Abbey in the dissolution, because certainly my understanding of it is that most of the abbeys around the country, the abbots, did what the king told them to and basically complied with this whole thing. We're getting rid of these abbeys now. That didn't quite happen down here, did it?
No, I don't think it did. It's an interesting case because obviously Glastonbury dissolved, one of the largest houses to be dissolved in the dissolution.
Why would a king look at the abbeys and say, we're not having any more of that?
I think it's largely due to the land ownership and financing, to be honest. Monasteries are massive economic powerhouses. I mean, you've got, you know, Glastonbury Abbey, one of the highest incomes of any monastery in the medieval period at the end of the life, earning over about £4,000 a year.
Well, 1535, it was valued then at what, in excess of, in today's money, of £1.3 billion, give or take. That gives you an idea of the wealth. I mean, that is a give or take figure, but it would probably be more.
And what were the activities that would bring about that wealth?
It's a combination of land ownership and business investment. And what
so
you
is
do
it just is rent collecting?
Rent collecting, very big part of it. But you've also got the idea that these places are businesses, so they invest. They invest very wisely often, and very unwisely in other cases, but they do invest in businesses. You've got to remember, for a lot of the medieval period as well, there's no banking system. So if you want a loan, where do you go to get a secured loan? You go to the monastery, you know, and the monastery has the money to lend you it. For example, we know that a number of very important people at the time of the dissolution owed Glastonbury Abbey money and things like this. And
that could be one of the motives.
Possibly something like that. But very much part of this idea of that these are great financial powerhouses. The more land you own, the more income you get, the more money you can invest in. And it is really important to note that for a lot of the Abbey's history is that we view this as being very isolated in England. I mean, to be honest, now we're standing in a small town in the middle of the English rural countryside. But you've really got to remember that for the whole of the monastery's life, we're on the international medieval highways here. There was a system of canals and river systems that linked Glastonbury with the Bristol Channel. And you would be able to get on a boat in northern France or even central France, sail obviously up through the Bristol Channel and not get off your boat till you arrived close to Glastonbury. So the idea that this is on those medieval highways, commerce and trade was on Glastonbury's doorstep.
Okay, so what were their main businesses, other than obviously they're collecting rent? That's easy. Well, can be easy, sometimes a bit more awkward. Was it things like wool, sheep,
well, that sort of quarries, sheep, huge. I mean, sheep wool was absolutely magnificent from the point of view of income, huge incomes from monasteries all over the country, and particularly in wool growing areas. So, I mean, wool and building mills. So, as Luke was saying, you invest in building a mill. So there'd be horse mills, windmills, water mills, all those sorts of infrastructure for roads, getting rents from roads and all that sort of thing. So, I mean, the whole thing was a big business.
A really good way of viewing the monastery here. I mean, it almost sounds a bit strange saying, but the monastery is its own centralised council, or own centralised government system. The large monasteries, there was an aspect of government control from kind of the monarch, as it were, on these areas. But a lot of the larger monasteries had a lot of sway to do their own thing. They own these lands, and because they're monastic land, it's meant to almost be outside of the control of the crown. It's not crown land, it's monastic land. So the monks have this kind of almost clause, get out jail free clause, to do what they want and to make their own decisions. And so it's in their best interest to invest in this land. Because and build these civil works, because that in time is an investment to produce money down there.
What sort of area around Somerset would the Abbey have controlled then? How far was its influence?
Well, we're looking at, by the time of the dissolution, we're looking at, in acreage, we're looking at about just over 120,000 acres of land. The modern county of Somerset does have just slightly more than that today, and that's of course spread across the south of England. In Somerset alone they had 56,000 acres, give or take, which is a third of the modern county. So it's a huge parcel. And we do occasionally find buildings around the country with unusual coat of arms on old farm buildings, and people always ask, well, where are these from? And they turn out to be from Glastonbury or something like that. Investment again in land elsewhere.
Okay, well, we've heard about sheep, we've heard about wool. What else would have been passing through the storehouses here?
Stonework. Also, produced goods. We know at one point there was a great tile works here at Gloucestershire. You're producing, you know, tiles here for chipping out. I believe it's Cleeve Abbey has some of the tiles produced here at Glastonbury Abbey. So they're actually producing almost monastic decoration for other monasteries, almost that sort of thing.
They're producing a lot of stuff that is used for building. Obviously, they're investing in these building projects. What about other things like consumables?
Oh, yes. I mean, alcohol, beer. I mean, we know that the... we've just been doing a project and we found that nearly 500,000 pints of beer were brewed here back in sort of late medieval times, and then when you add cider onto that, which was about 250,000 pints of cider. So I mean, you're looking at that. Some of that was consumed, but a lot of it, some of it would have been sold.
A good third of it, I believe, was earmarked for selling, as far as we can tell. And of course, because beer is incredibly important for a lot of the poor who don't have access to clean spring water. You don't have filtered lovely water like we have today. It's beer is that replacement for water in your diet. And we are talking a lot of the time about small beer here, you know, weak beer as we'd call it today, you know, looking at between 1% and 2% in alcoholic content. But that brewing process kills off bacteria, so beer was a life source almost for the people. It replaced water in your diet, and that also made it incredibly lucrative to invest and produce. And we do find various monasteries around the Britain do actually end up owning a monopoly on the license to brew on their land. So you're kind of almost monopolising this as well.
This is bound to cause a bit of resentment, I guess, as well, isn't it? So that may have been one of the reasons why, when the dissolution happened, people weren't so upset. What about spirits and liqueurs?
Not here that we know of. I mean, we have to be very careful.
The hard stuff.
We do know that they're producing wines, but not necessarily spirits. I don't know.
I've just been reading a document that at the dissolution, one of the abbots of another monastery near here took with him the still and everything else, and he left it in his will to the children. So at the dissolution, he took the still and all the other materials. So yes, they were doing something. I don't know what they were producing, but yes, there is evidence of monastic movement around here, having stills and obviously brewing spirits.
Now, it makes me actually think of some of the big kind of almost like supermarkets that we've got today as the equivalent.
Yeah, well, because you see timber, so not only were they controlling the stone, they were controlling timber. You think of a huge fish farm down there, down at Mere, so they were controlling fish. So, I mean, a lot of the food production was actually being controlled. So, I mean, if you think of a sort of medieval Amazon, .com. you're looking at Glaston. Just ask Glaston.
Okay. So we've been talking about a lot of the food that was produced here, and I guess this stands on its own. This is a kitchen of some sort.
Yeah, it's the abbot's kitchen of the monastery. And there would have been two kitchens on the site, or two principal kitchens, one for the abbot and his guests, which were standing in now, and the other for the monks, which would have been in the monks' quarters. But we're very much standing now in the prestigious kitchen of the monastery.
There's an elite here.
Yes,
so if you're an ordinary monk, you're not part of the elite, are you?
No, not at all, no. I mean, as with any organisation and institution and place of business, you have a hierarchy. It's exactly the same within the monastery, and certainly throughout the monastery's history we see this develop, as it were. Now I always view Glastonbury having such a separate Abbot's Quarters and Abbot's Apartment. And we do see this other monasteries like Glastonbury because of, obviously, the kind of exceptional status of Glastonbury as being basically, other than a couple of others, one of the premier monasteries in England. You've got to remember, the Abbot of Glastonbury is an exceptionally powerful man, both politically and financially. And so he needs something to reflect that status. And this is part of that, part of an entertainment complex.
Probably he is as a Christian, he's supposed to be a humble man.
Well, in essence, I suppose.
All things can go wrong at some time or other. We're sinners, all of us.
They usually do, don't they?
Yeah, they usually do. Well, yeah, there is that idea. He's meant to be a humble man according to his rule and his creed and belief.
It depends who's writing the history. I mean, we do have to remember in all this that what we have is the written accounts, and we have to remember who's writing the history, and it sometimes is not the real, true, complex story.
I mean, before we talk a bit more about this building, what about how you know? I mean, have you got any records from the Abbey? Because I would imagine there would be a library here in the 16th century. Doesn't seem to be a library now. Were there any records from that?
Oh, yes. I mean, Leighton says it was one of the, probably the best library in the country, I believe. We had hundreds, if not thousands, of manuscripts, many of which would have got destroyed. Some have been kept, and of course they are in various museums and archives.
We actually have records of what was going on here?
So we certainly do have evidence for things happening and what goes on in the monastery throughout history. Unfortunately, they tend to be quite fragmented and scattered in terms of their direct. So we
do we know what happened to the library? That sounds like quite a loss.
We really don't. All we know is that it's not here anymore. There's suggestions that it was destroyed at the dissolution. There's local story, almost hearsay, of the pages from the beautiful books being taken and given to local merchants to wrap their wares in, and things like this. They're all a bit anecdotal. Certainly the books would have had a high value to them. It doesn't make sense for a lot of them to be outright disposed of and destroyed, because these would have been copies of ancient texts, so Greek and Roman texts, Arabic texts, and these would have been of exceptional high value. They probably, I imagine, be itemised and sold off, because of course books back then were exceptionally valuable, unlike today when we get them from Amazon for 2p. You're talking books have the individual value of, say, in a modern value of, you know, kind of, you know, £1,000 going upwards to the heavens, depending on how ornate and what content it had in it. So I always like to think, there's entirely a personal opinion, that it was probably itemised and sold off or taken somewhere else.
Or looted,
yeah, exactly, looted. A lot of these books, some of the more valuable ones, would have had covers that were decorated with, you know, gilt, gold and silver gemstones, very beautiful leather and beautiful gold and silver clasps and catches to hold them closed. So, yeah, there would have been that aspect of possible snatch and grab about the whole dissolution, and the lovely book slipping into a labourer's day bag or something like that, but we don't really know, and that's the sad thing. We can only surmise and guess.
Longleat has quite a good archive of some of the manuscripts from here. So does Oxford and Cambridge and the British Library. Also, Taunton. I mean, there's quite a lot of good stuff down at Taunton.
Was there actually quite a lot of writing scribes actually writing books? Because, of course, this is before the age of printing, pretty much, when in its heyday here.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, we know there would have been a large number of books produced at the Abbey. Often books were produced by commission as well. So you wouldn't just write books for the sake of writing books. There's often a purpose to it. So whether or not a new copy needs to be made, or someone has commissioned the monks to make a copy. They're also not just writing books. They're also drafting things like legal documents and conveyances, because most people don't, you know, read or write. So even the nobility at times can't read or write. So you need someone you can go to and tell what you want on a document or something, and you'll go to a monastery. That does mean that sometimes we have scribes being paid to work in monasteries who aren't monks, professional writers as well. So it very much is an industry of writing.
Thank you.
That's all for this week, Dialects Bristol's first weekly podcast. You can download to listen on your phone or in the car. Subscribe and listen the week before broadcast if you like at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Mark Hutchinson and Luke Loder from the Education Department down at Glastonbury Abbey, and to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production catches on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us at the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street, online at prsc.org.uk, and you can talk to the PRSC Arts Centre on 0117 909 6897 or the China Shop on 944 4540. Volunteer with us if you like, or for hundreds of opportunities across Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 to 8pm. Meanwhile, till the same time next week, here on Dialect, with more from Glastonbury. Goodbye for now.
I believe in God.
I believe in God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, and in Jesus Christ, his only Son, our Lord, who was conceived by the Holy Ghost, born of the Virgin Mary, suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, dead, and buried. The third day he rose again from the dead. He ascended into heaven, and sitteth on the right hand of God the Father Almighty. From thence he shall come to judge the quick and the dead. I believe in the Holy Ghost, the Holy Catholic Church, the communion of saints, the forgiveness of sins, the resurrection of the body, and the life everlasting.
Te Deum laudamus, Te Dominum confitemus, Te Eternum Patrem omnis terra veneratus, Tibi omnes angeli, Tibi sedile universe potestas, incessabili voce proclama.
Sanctus, Sanctus, Sanctus Dominus Deus Sabaoth.
Plenis un celi et terra majestatis gloriae tue.
Te gloriosus apostolorum
laudabilis numerus,
te martyrum candidatus laudate exercitus,
te per orbem terrarum sancta confitetur ecclesia. Termus est filius,
tu ad libem rangum susceptorus hominem, non horuis civilis uterum.
Tu de victum mortis aculeo, aperum isti credentibus regna cellorum.
Tu ad dexteram Dei
crederis esse venturus.
Tenendo quesumus suis fabulis ultemi, quos preciosus sanguine redemis
eterna fama, cum sanctis tuis gloria numera.
Deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom,